Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 31st of March 2023 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 71 and we are currently looking at the Danelaw and we are looking at battles between the Danes and the Saxons and we are about to enter this rather excellent period of Danish rule by Canute the Great. And I have with me today my two co-hosts. I have Truthvids from truthvids.net and the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Truthvids, good day, sir. How are you doing?
All good. Looking forward to discussing more on the barbarian Viking Knut, who became a great Christian ruler of England, right?
He certainly did. Patriarch, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, Sven. Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. I enjoyed the snow over the weekend while it lasted.
Yeah, it missed me, thankfully, because I had a little bit of a I guess you could call it a minor accident in my car the last time the snow was here. So I'm glad that I missed out on that, but it did look very picturesque throughout the rest of the country. Well, let's get back into Canute here. And in the last episode, we were quoting from Sharon Turner about these final battles that Edmund Ironside had with Canute, and we're going to start off with quoting from Wikipedia now, which basically sums up the last series of quotes that we had from Sharon Turner. So Wikipedia says, on 18th of October 1016, the Danes were engaged by Edmund's army as they retired towards their ships, leading to the Battle of Assandun, fought at either Ashingdon in the southeast or Ashton in northwest Essex. In the ensuing struggle, Edric Streona, whose return to the English side had perhaps only been a ruse, withdrew his forces from the fray, bringing about a decisive English defeat. Edmund fled westwards and Canute pursued him to Gloucestershire, with another battle probably fought near the Forest of Dean, for Edmund by that time had an alliance with some of the Welsh. On an island near Deerhurst, Canute and Edmund, who had been wounded, met to negotiate terms of peace. It was agreed that all of England north of the Thames was to be the domain of the Danish prince, while all to the south was kept by the English king along with London. Accession to the reign of the entire realm was set to pass to Canute upon Edmund's death, and Edmund died on the 30th of November within weeks of the arrangement, and some sources claim that Edmund was murdered, although the circumstances of his death are unknown. And the West Saxons now accepted Canute as the King of all England, and he was crowned by Lyfing, the Archbishop of Canterbury in London in 1017. So interesting there, Wikipedia doesn't seem to give much credit to these accounts that he was murdered, but Sharon Turner says that it was written about by quite a few bards, and the Knytlinger Saga and Saxo Grammaticus say that the crime originated with Canute, and it was a violent death, and that two of his chamberlains were seduced by Edric to wound him with an iron hook at his most private moment, which sounds really twisted, horrible way to die. So you would think that if somebody had died like that, there would be records of it, and Sharon Turner says there is records of it. But Wikipedia just claims some sources claim he was murdered, although the circumstances of his death are unknown. What do you think happened, Truthvids? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think he was definitely murdered, right? I mean, many sources say that, but I know Wikipedia don't want, us looking into ancient history. They don't want us reading the, Nordic sagas or the Saxon Grammaticus or the history of the Saxons. They just like brief summaries and to move us on and to keep telling us how bad everything was back then, you know, under these kings, until we got, the enlightenment of democracy and everything's great and dandy now, right?
Yeah, Saxo Grammaticus, Book of the Danes, I really do recommend that. That's a really great read. I can remember being really amazed by that when I read it, actually. It was really, really detailed, and it seemed to me to have a lot of morality that came across, and a good description of the way that the people lived back then and the importance that they placed on poetry and skill in being able to tell sagas and in poetry form. So I guess it was almost like rapping today. So we had Danish rappers 1,000 years before we had black rappers. Patriarch, what are your thoughts on this death and what happened here?
Yeah, well, it's I guess it would be a massive coincidence if he just died of natural causes. But you know, if there's accounts of it elsewhere, then it's likely that he did die. I just wonder, you know, where that leaves Canute, because I thought that he did an honourable thing. Obviously, being willing to share his dominion. But then I don't understand why he would have changed his mind, unless the duration that they were ruling, he had a change of heart and realised that it would be best for him to rule. Or I don't know the general circumstances around it at the time. It might be worth looking into that a bit more.
Yeah, have a look at the primary sources and what they say about it. I mean, death by disemboweling with an iron hook. I mean, if somebody says that happened, there has to have been evidence for that to have happened, and yet it just gets glossed over. Well, Canute ruled England for nearly 2 decades, and the protection he lent against Viking raiders, many of them under his command, restored the prosperity that had been increasingly impaired since the resumption of Viking attacks in the 980s. And in turn, the English helped him to establish control over the majority of Scandinavia too. Under his rule, England did not experience any serious external attacks. And that's where we'll finish off with Wikipedia there, and we'll move back into Sharon Turner for a description of Canute. Canute, from his warlike ability, surnamed the Brave, from his renown and empire, the Great, from his liberality, the Rich, and from his devotion, the Pious, obtained on Edmund's death the sovereignty of all England at the age of 20. The Northerns have transmitted to us the portrait of Canute. He was large in stature and very powerful. He was fair and distinguished for his beauty. His nose was thin, eminent, and aquiline. His hair was profuse, his eyes bright and fierce. He was chosen king by general assent, and his partisans were numerous in the country, and who could resist his power? His measures to secure his crown were sanguinary and tyrannical, but the whole of Canute's character breathes an air of barbaric grandeur. He was formed by nature to tower amidst his contemporaries, but his country and his education intermixed his greatness with a ferocity that compels us to shudder whilst we admire. In one respect, he was fortunate, his mind and manners refined as his age matured, and the first part of his reign was cruel and unclouded. I really do like Sharon Turner's descriptions here. He certainly has a way with words, doesn't he? What are your thoughts on this description? And do you want to make a brief summary of Canute's rule for these 2 decades, Truefids?
Yeah, you can understand that his sister was assassinated and many of his fellow Danes were massacred. So obviously he sought revenge. And, you know, in the war, that there's always atrocities. But once he had the kingdom, that's when you really see his character. Later on, Sharon Turner gives another description. And as he ruled the entire empire, he could virtually be whatever type of person he wanted to be, right? And the fact that he chose to be Christian and to follow the Christian laws shows you what type of character he really was. He really was a pious king, right?
It shows you that he was battling from a very young age as well to become king at the age of 20. I mean, these battles that he's been involved in have been going on, must be at least 5 years worth of battles that he's been involved in, this battle-hardened king, and then to become king at 20. You would imagine that there may have been some immaturity, I guess, in the first years of his reign, and particular ferociousness, as Sharon Turner says here, because, as you pointed out, of all these Danes that have been murdered, that St. Bryce's Day massacre was still within the memory, I think. That happened possibly 10 years before this point, maybe even less time than that, but it certainly needed avenging. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Well, he was clearly respected, and I think you know, someone that he obviously commanded respect and earned his respect probably through his, you know, his endeavours. Obviously quite violent and bloody, but maybe, you know, it's the kind of fear turned to respect, and he obviously showed that he could bring peace after the after war, I think. So I think he would have earned people's respect as, you know, a real strong leader.
Well, they certainly showed it, didn't they, with these different surnames for him: Canute the Brave, Canute the Great, Canute the Rich, Canute the Pious. I mean, just about everything there, going from being brave to also being pious. Well, his first policy was against the children of Ethelred and Edmund. One of his skalds, Sigvatar, sings that all the sons of Ethelred he slew or banished. The Saxon Annalist assures us that he determined at first to exile Edwig, the half-brother of Edmund, but finding the English nobles both submissive and adulating, he proceeded to gratify his ambition by taking the prince's life. The infamous Edric suggested to him a man, Ethelwald, a nobleman of high descent, who would undertake to accomplish his criminal desires. The king incited Ethelwald to the measure: "Acquiesce with my wishes, and you shall enjoy securely all the honour and dignity of your ancestors. Bring me his head, and you shall be dearer to me than a brother." This was the language of a northern Viking to whom human life was of no value. Ethelwald affected a compliance, but his seeming readiness was but an artifice to get the child into his power and to preserve his life. Edwig, though, did not ultimately escape. The next year he was deceived by those whom he most esteemed, and by Canute's request and command, he was put to death. Interesting here that he decides that he's going to go and kill him, even though he found the English nobles both submissive and adulating. So they were supporting him, and instead of thinking, well, they are supporting me, I don't want to upset them by killing the princes or killing the noblemen, he must have thought, because of that, then they're not going to put up any resistance if he does kill the prince. So I'm surprised that he did that, but he must have had advice that was the correct thing to do. And what do you make of this this murder that took place here, Truefids?
Yeah, he obviously thought there was a threat to his kingship, and, you know, a lot of the nobles were probably just sick of having decades of war and just wanted peace and were happy if Canute just reigned. But it's interesting how it turns out, right, that he asked Edric to do it, Edwig, and then he gets somebody else, and the other guy actually is just doing it so that he can get the son and then secretly get him safely out of there. But the guy at the top, who was, you know, more than happy to do it, he ends up getting killed anyway. So it's just funny how that worked out, right?
Yes, poetic justice there in the end. Patriarch, any thoughts on what's going on here?
I mean, I'm surprised. Well, not surprised, because it's I guess it was quite normal for kings to want to preserve and protect their throne and take precaution. But I don't know, it's hard to balance that with, you know, being of a Christian mind, isn't it, where you're not supposed to kill your brother and this, and then obviously he would go out his way to do that. So it's just making just trying to understand it really on that level.
Yeah, he's certainly not showing his Christianity at this point. He's being quite bloodthirsty. But yeah, I guess he's got to get those people out of the way that might also make a claim to the throne, that might be able to rally the Saxons against him. Well, with the same guilty purpose, Canute seized Edward and Edmund, the children of the last king, but he was counseled that the country would not endure their destruction. Alarmed from immediate crime, he sent them to the king of Sweden to be killed. But this prince was too noble to be a murderer, and he had them conveyed to Solomon, the king of Hungary, to be preserved and educated. One died, the other, Edward, married Agatha, the daughter of Henry, the German emperor, and their issue was Edgar Etheling, who will be remembered in a future reign. So one of his descendants did actually come back to rule Britain. This is interesting here. These other kings wouldn't do it either. So he didn't want to do it. And he thought that the country would revolt against him if he did, but these other kings didn't want to do it either. So this, you know, this shows that they weren't quite so barbaric as we first thought. True Foods, any thoughts?
Well, there's also the fact that kings didn't like other kings or princes being executed. They kind of liked keeping this divinity, or, you know, semi-divinity, that no, you can't kill a king, because obviously they don't ever want it to happen to them or their descendants, right? So if they just move them off, then they know later on, if things turn around and their son or grandson loses the kingdom, well, he would be protected. Someone couldn't say, oh, well, you remember when his grandfather executed all those princes or the kings, let's kill him now. You get what I mean? It was also a self-interest as well. But yeah, I do think that generally they just didn't want to have the blood on their hands and be murderers.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Any comments you want to add to this, Patriarch?
I guess he may have been well connected himself, you know, for the reasons that Truth has pointed out. You know, if he had a lot of you know, deep connections, and he was, you know, revered or respected by many other people, again, it could have conjured up a wave of hatred or animosity their way. So yeah, I completely understand that.
Oh, it would have been one of the great grandchildren of Alfred the Great as well, so coming from an illustrious family. Well, the punishment of Edric would have been a homage to virtue from any other person than Canute. The crime he prompted, he should not have punished, but it is an observation almost as old as human nature that traitors are abhorred by their employers. In the first days of Canute's unsettled throne, he confirmed Edric in his Mercian dukedom, but having used the profligate Saxon to establish his dignity, on the next claim of reward, he expressed his latent feelings. Edric imprudently boasted of his services. I first deserted Edmund to benefit you. For you, I killed him. Canute coloured, for the anger of conscious guilt and irrepressible shame came upon him. 'Tis fit, then, that you should die for your treason to God and to me. You killed your own lord, him who by treaty and friendship was my brother. Your blood be upon your own head. For murdering the Lord's anointed, your own lips bear witness against you. The villain who perpetrated the fact was confounded by the hypocrite who had countenanced it. Eric, the ruler of Norway, was called in that the royal intention might be secretly executed, and he struck down the wretch with his battle axe, and the body was thrown from the window into the Thames before any tumult could be raised among his partisans. The two sons of Ethelred by Emma were then sheltered in Normandy. So interesting there. I mean, that seems to be saying that Edric was boasting of the fact that he killed Edmund with this hook, and that Canute wasn't a part of it. So it must have just been this one particular report that said that Canute ordered it. Perhaps he didn't order it, and he slaughtered him for being a traitor. What are your thoughts on this, True Fitz?
Well, one thing I find really interesting is the words that Canute uses, because they're straight from the Bible. You know, when King David and King Saul, they're having that contention, and then, you know, King Saul is sentenced to death by God because he's performed necromancy, called up a spirit, and he says, basically, you're doomed now. And then he goes out to die. And then he has a battle with the Philistines, and then he's really badly wounded. And then later, King David, he finds out what happened because a random stranger just happened to pass by, and Saul asked him to finish me off. And he comes to David and says, well, I've killed Saul, so now you're king. And rather than David rewarding him or anything like that, David's shocked, and he says, thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth have testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed. And that's exactly what Canute said to Edric. So it just shows you that Canute must have been reading the Bible. You know, he wasn't just a Christian. He actually was reading it as well. And this is that they really looked up to King David and Solomon as an example of what type of king they should be, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. I picked up on the bit, like, your blood be upon your own head. I mean, that comes from the Bible. I didn't realize it came from a direct quote there. I mean, that blood be upon you is because blood has to be paid for with blood. If somebody murders someone, then the state has to execute the murderer. Otherwise, that blood is upon the state for not doing it. So this is why he says the blood be upon your own head, because it's the king that killed him. So normally the blood would be upon the king. But because Edric has murdered somebody else, he has to pay for it with his own life. So his blood is upon his own head, as it were. Any comments you want to add to this, Patriarch?
I wonder what Edric would have had to gain. Perhaps he thought that with Edmund out of the way, that he'd be, be almost like second in command or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, why did he do that? The kingdom had been split between the two. But again, it shows you that just being a traitor is a horrible, horrible character trait. And even the people that you're becoming a traitor to serve are going to realize that you're a traitor. And you've got that's a horrible character trait. Even if you're, if you're serving the person who is not who you should be loyal to, they're going to realize that you're a traitor to your own people. Even though you're serving them, you're a traitor. I mean, they're worth nothing, are they, traitors? In 1018, Canute married Emma, also called Elfgiver, the widow of Ethelred. Interesting there. So married the former queen. He distinguished his next year by a most oppressive exaction. From London, he compelled £10,500, and from the rest of the kingdom, £72,000. To soothe the country, he sent home the largest portion of his Danish troops, keeping only 40 vessels in England. And in this, he displayed the confidence of a noble mind. He maintained an exact equality between the two nations in ranks, council, and war. And in 1019, England was so tranquil that he went to Denmark and passed the winter in his native county. So that's interesting. So he sets up like a Wittenagemot or a parliament with exact equality between the English and the Danish with whatever nobility that they were. And that forms his advisors. And also interesting that he marries, the former queen. Again, that shows you that women were seen, especially in that position, it was they had to marry who they were told to marry. And you think that if love was involved in this, she would obviously hate him for killing her husband. But that isn't so. This is, you know, a purely sort of like a business transaction rather than marrying for love, I think. Truthids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, Emma, that was actually the daughter of the Normandy king as well, I believe. And I don't think Canute actually killed the husband, right, Ethelred, but the son of Ethelred, but the son was from a previous wife. Emma wasn't the mother. And obviously, if Emma marries Canute, then her sons will end up being kings. And I think they did in the later reign. Yeah, and as for Canute extracting all this money, wars aren't cheap. If you bring over all these nobles and all these fighters and warriors and soldiers, they're going to want something in return. So Canute had to pay them or give them some kind of land. So by taking all this money, he could pay them and just send them home. We see later on that William the Conqueror didn't. He instead removed all the nobility and put his own nobility over them, thus creating a kind of tyranny. And here Canute's done it differently. He's took a lot of money, but allowed the English to still have a lot of control and kept their own laws over their own kingdom, right?
Yeah, I find it interesting that Emma or Elfgiver is putting the further generations from her, she's putting their needs ahead of her own. Because as you said, that any issue from her would then be princes. So she's putting their needs and the fact that they could then become royalty above any animosity that she might have for Canute for killing members of her own family. So she must have been a fairly selfless woman there, I think. Patriarch, any commentary you want to put with this?
I'm just trying to, so basically he the relations to who was it that was killed? Eric or
Edric.
One of the, Edric,
was,
sorry.
Edric was the traitor.
Yeah, so Edric was killed, and then to maybe make sure that there was no future animosity with their bloodlines, they kind of married back into noble lines so that they're, you know, they wouldn't begrudge.
Yeah, that's a good point. Again, putting the peace of future generations ahead of anything that was going on at the time. Yeah, so that was a very clever move, very shrewd move by Canute.
And then, yeah, and then obviously we read that it was so tranquil, so there must have been a lot of peace at that time for him to feel that he could go back home to his native land. Everything was, you know, kind of cohesive and orderly.
Everything was settled. Moving on here. As Danish King of England, Canute was quick to eliminate any prospective challenge from the survivors of the mighty Wessex dynasty. The first year of his reign was marked by the executions of a number of English noblemen whom he considered suspect. And of course, we're moving back to Wikipedia here for the notes. Ethelred's son, Edwig Etheling, fled from England, but was killed on Canute's orders. Edmund Ironside's sons likewise fled abroad. Ethelred's sons, by Emma of Normandy, went under the protection of their relatives in the Duchy of Normandy. In July 1017, Canute wed Queen Emma, the widow of Ethelred and the daughter of Richard I, Duke of Normandy. In 1018, having collected a Danegeld amounting to the colossal sum of £72,000 levied nationwide, with an additional 10,500 extracted from London, Canute paid off his army and sent most of them home. He retained 40 ships and their crews as a standing force in England, and an annual tax called Heregeld, or Heregeld, which is an army payment, was collected through the same system that Ethelred had instituted in 1012 to reward Scandinavians in his service. Canute built on the existing English trend for multiple shires to be grouped together under a single ealdorman, thusly dividing the country into four large administrative units whose geographical extent was based on the largest and most durable of the separate kingdoms that had preceded the unification of England. The officials responsible for these provinces were designated earls, a title of Scandinavian origin already in localised use in England, which now everywhere replaced that of ealdorman. Wessex was initially kept under Canute's personal control, while Northumbria went to Eric of Hlothere, East Anglia to Thorkell the Tall, and Mercia remained in the hands of Edric Streona. But this initial distribution of power was short-lived. The chronically treacherous Edric was executed within a year of Canute's accession, and Mercia passed to one of the leading families of the region, probably first to Leofwine, ealdorman of the Hwicci under Ethelred, but certainly soon to his son Leofric. In 1021, Thorkell also fell from favour and was outlawed. Following his death in the 1020s, Eric of Hlothere was succeeded as Earl of Northumbria by Siward, whose grandmother Estrid, married to Ulfhere Thorgilsson, was Canute's sister. Bernicia, the northern part of Northumbria, was theoretically a part of Eric and Siward's earldom, but throughout Canute's reign, it effectively remained under the control of the English dynasty based at Bamburgh, which had dominated the area at least since the early 10th century. They served as junior earls of Bernicia under the titular authority of the Earl of Northumbria. By the 1030s, Canute's direct administration of Wessex had come to an end, with the establishment of an earldom under Godwin, an Englishman from a powerful Sussex family. In general, after initial reliance on his Scandinavian followers in the first years of his reign, Canute allowed those Anglo-Saxon families of the existing English nobility who had earned his trust to assume rulership of his earldoms. So effectively what we see there is that these parts of the country cease to be ruled by princes and kings, and you have one king over the whole of England, which is Canute. And then these other parts of his kingdom are now ruled by earls, which are from these Anglo-Saxon families that are obviously don't really have a problem with being ruled by this Danish royal family, was essentially from the same royal family as the Saxon royal family, anyway, as all the royal families were within Europe, as we've talked about before. Any thoughts on this, Treefids?
Yeah, so here we see also the rise of Godwin. That's the father of Harold, right, who would later come to fight two kings, the other Harold and William later. But yeah, it's interesting how he divided it into four. And we see initially Edric was rewarded with Mercia, but then he killed him, right? Obviously, because he thought he was a traitor. The other guy, Fordek the Tall, was that not the guy who trained him? Who raised him in war, I believe. So it was kind of a reward, right? But perhaps it seems that they fell out of favor later. And then later, the Anglo-Saxons were eventually allowed to re-rule their own territories. Obviously, Cnut could see there was no rebellions and that they were kind of integrating Danish and Anglo-Saxons. So it all kind of gradually settled, right?
Yeah, settled enough for him to build up an empire. Interesting there you said about Harold, Godwin's son, because he's called Harold Godwinson, isn't he? Is what his name is. So that's where he must get his name from, the son of Godwin. Yeah, Patriot, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think it's quite a clever move from Cnut to divide the kingdom into lesser rulers. And I guess that would help him to secure his position on top, because then obviously if one of the kingdoms did have a thirst for more power, then there were three others to keep them in check, you know. So, yeah, I think that was a pretty clever move on his behalf, unless they all ganged up on him, but it's probably less likely, isn't it?
Yeah, and that will also aid him in gathering his tax to pay for the army to defend the country in case some more rebellious bands of Vikings come across. But most of them by this point were under Cnut anyway. Well, let's move on to the affairs to the east. At the Battle of Nesjar in 1016, Olaf Haraldsson won the Kingdom of Norway from the Danes. It was at some time after Eric left for England, and on the death of Svein while retreating to Sweden, maybe intent on returning to Norway with reinforcements, that Eric's son Hakon went to join his father and support Cnut in England too. Cnut's brother Harald may have been at Cnut's coronation in 1016, returning to Denmark as its king with part of the fleet at some point thereafter. It is only certain, though, that there was an entry of his name alongside Cnut's in confraternity with Christchurch, Canterbury in 1018. This is not conclusive, though, for the entry may have been made in Harald's absence, perhaps by the hand of Cnut himself. Which means that while it is usually thought that Harald died in 1018, it is unsure whether he was still alive at this point. Entry of his brother's name in the Canterbury Codex may have been Cnut's attempt to make his vengeance for Harald's murder good with the church. This may have been just a gesture for a soul to be under the protection of God. There is evidence Cnut was in battle with pirates in 1018, with his destruction of the crews of 30 ships, although it is unknown if this was off the English or the Danish shores. He himself mentions troubles in his 1019 letter to England from Denmark, written as the King of England and Denmark. These events can be seen, with plausibility, to be in connection with the death of Harald. Cnut says he dealt with dissenters to ensure Denmark was free to assist England, and this is what he says here. King Cnut greets in friendship his archbishop and his diocesan bishops and Earl Thurkill and all his earls, ecclesiastic and laymen in England. I inform you that I will be a gracious lord and a faithful observer of God's rights and just secular law. And he then exhorts his eldermen to assist the bishops in the maintenance of God's rights and the benefit of the people. If anyone, ecclesiastic or layman, Dane or Englishman, is so presumptuous as to defy God's law and my royal authority or the secular laws, and he will not make amends and desist according to the direction of my bishops, I then pray and also command Earl Thurkill, if he can, to cause the evildoer to do right, and if he cannot, then it is my will that with the power of us both he shall destroy him in the land, or drive him out of the land, whether he be of high or low rank. And it is my will that all the nation, ecclesiastical and lay, shall steadfastly observe Edgar's laws, which all men have chosen and sworn at Oxford. Since I did not spare my money, as long as hostility was threatening you, I, with God's help, have put an end to it. Then I was informed that greater danger was approaching us than we liked at all, and then I went myself with the men who accompanied me to Denmark, from where the greatest injury had come to us, and with God's help I have made it so that never henceforth shall hostility reach you from there, as long as you support me rightly and my life lasts. Now I thank Almighty God for his help and his mercy, that I have settled the great dangers which were approaching us, that we need fear no danger to us from there, but we may reckon on full help and deliverance if we need it. And that's from Canute's letter of 1019. So it seems that there were some rebellious types, I guess, that were coming over from Denmark and acting like pirates or attacking the English. And he went over there and put a stop to that. And it also shows us here the importance of God's laws, basically, common law and the laws of the Bible, biblical law and secular law. And the bishops obviously have a lot of power at this point. Treefids, any thoughts?
Yeah, where he says under Edgar law, it seems that he's letting England keep, you know, their Anglo-Saxon laws, and he's not interfering too much, although, of course, they have to obey the laws of the Bible. And over in Dane, they have perhaps slightly different laws, but he didn't interfere too much. That's at least my interpretation of it. And where he had to go over to Denmark, it was probably also because his brother passed away, and his brother had no descendants, so Knut would be the heir. And he went over to make sure that he was accepted as king and bring it into his kingdom, right?
Yeah, there's also a bit here about Harold's murder that we'll get into in a minute as well, with Sharon Turner's quotes on this. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Just understanding the role of the king and how they see themselves as literally doing the work of God. And I think in many ways that's why they often justified, you know, killings and stuff. You know, as kings they were clearly sort of above the general laws of murder and so, because, you know, they regard it as God's will.
Well, they were the enforcer of the law, weren't they? And they were answerable to God for ensuring that God's law was kept within the realm. So they themselves were, you know, above the law, as it were, which is why you couldn't take a king to court. I mean, even today, it's the crown versus whatsoever, because all right to enforce the law comes from the crown. It comes from the king, and the king gets his right to rule from God because he enforces God's law on earth within his realm. So that's the way that it works. And yeah, it shows that they took this very, very seriously back then. Well, again, let's have a look at what Sharon Turner has to say about this period. Canute went to Denmark, where he was attacked by Ulfhere and Iglaf with a fleet and army from Sweden. In one struggle, Canute was unsuccessful, but afterwards the young Earl Godwin attacked the enemies of Canute by surprise with the English troops and obtained a complete victory. This event raised Godwin and the English very greatly in the king's estimation. The Eglaf was Saint Olaf, who had possessed himself of the kingdom of Norway. Canute, occupied by his English crown, made at first no pretensions to the Norwegian sceptre. The submission of England gave him leisure to turn the eye of ambition to the mountains of Norway. Claims those slight veils with which states desirous of war always cover their unjust projects, to conceal their deformity from the giddy populace, claims adapted to interest the passions of vulgar prejudice existed to befriend Canute. His father had conquered Norway, his relation Hakko had been driven from it. Many of the people who he had most loudly welcomed, including Saint Olaf, had become dissatisfied at his innovations and invited Canute to intervene. Ulfhere at first was among the enemies of Canute. He was afterwards pardoned and reconciled, and in the king's conflict with the Swedes was the means of saving Canute's life. At a feast in Rothschild, Canute, according to Snorri, quarrelled with Ulfhere at gaming. The indignant Jarl prudently retired. Canute taunted him on his cowardice for withdrawing. "Was I a coward when I rescued you from the fangs of the Swedish dogs?" was the answer of the irritated Ulfhere. Canute went to his couch and slept upon his resentment, but his fierce and haughty soul waked in the morning to demand blood. He sent his mandate, and Ulfhere was stabbed in a church which he had entered. Canute descended so far beneath the courage of a hero as to corrupt the subjects of Olav from their fidelity money, and Canute supported his insidious negotiations by a powerful fleet. 50 ships of English Dane thanes were with him, and every district in Norway which he approached accepted him as its lord. He exacted for hostages the sons and dearest relations of the chiefs of Norway, and appointed Hakko, the son of his friend Erik, to be the governor of his conquests. Interesting that we have this Iglaf who became Saint Olav, because it's not very often that people become saints that are actually involved in battles. So I guess what we're seeing here is how he became the king of Norway. Trufids, any thoughts on what's going on here?
Yeah, I think they were actually playing a game of chess. I double-checked it on Wikipedia, so it's interesting to high-up Danes, you know, a king and a lord or an earl having a game of chess. Even 1,000 years ago, you know, they were playing it. But yeah, here you see Canute, he's still young at this point, and, you know, he still has that hot temper of, you know, a barbaric Viking. And of course, later he will regret it, right? His friend snaps back at him, and he's been really irritated at that. And then in the end, he's demanded that he die for that, even though days later he would regret it, right?
Yeah, he's acted in haste. I mean, at the same time, he can't have insubordination, but at the same time, I mean, this was a friend of his who had actually rescued him. So, I mean, he must have been troubled by guilt after this, I think. Patriarch, any thoughts?
I wonder what it was, what he took insult by. I mean, the fact he was rescued, maybe he feels it's kind of a stigma on his legacy that, you know, he was, you know, that someone else kind of, I don't know, was in some ways helped to shape his success. It's hard to understand, isn't it, why he would kill someone over that. Maybe, I don't know, he just felt so prideful in his position of power that he felt, who was this guy to talk to me?
Yeah, it was denting his pride, I guess, by reminding him that he had to be rescued by him. Well, Canute was generally remembered as a wise and successful king of England, although this view may in part be attributable to his good treatment of the church, the keeper of the historic record. And once again, we're with Wikipedia here. Accordingly, we hear of him even today as a religious man, despite the fact that he was in an arguably sinful relationship with two wives and the harsh treatment he dealt his fellow Christian opponents. Well, it doesn't tell us in the Bible that we have to have one wife, although that is ideal. Eve was created for Adam, but there isn't actually any limitation on the number of wives. I think the church just referred back to this original marriage between Adam and Eve, because we do hear of there being more than one wife for various reasons. Trufids, perhaps you want to elaborate on that, about him having two wives here.
Yeah, obviously it was, he didn't probably intend to one day have two wives. It was just he had a wife back in, you know, Scandinavia, and then when he took England to secure it and to make sure that all the lords of England were happy, he married the former queen just to say, yes, you know, I'm marrying the queen of the Saxons. You're going to keep your laws. Don't worry. Don't rebel against me. Interestingly, when I was looking on Wikipedia as well, they referred to a man, you know, sleeping with a woman and just taking her as his wife, as the Danish way. But really, that was just the normal way. It seems at that point they were accepting it's only a marriage if you know, some priest or a church authorizes it, or they're married in a church. But the Danish way was just the old fashioned way, where you just take a woman, she moves in with you, and that's it, right? You just say, oh, this is my wife now. But yeah, that's my thoughts on that anyways.
Yeah, it's interesting that coincides with when we were talking about Harald Dahr and his laws, weren't they, about his laws on marriage, and we were saying it there, that the marriage is the consummation of the marriage. So you have the same thing happening with the Danes here. And it must have been at this period or slightly before that the church came in there and said that a marriage had to be officiated by the church, and it then became the marriage ceremony. And then from that, it was able to get redefined so that you could have gay gay marriage, but we've talked about that before. And Patriarch, do you want to make any comments about him having two wives here?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I know the likes of Abraham did it, you know, had multiple wives and Solomon and whatnot. As for being biblically, I don't know, I would say that it's always best for, you know, well, marriage is better defined between one man and one woman. I mean, as Christ puts it, you become one flesh. I mean, then if we're to take that and extrapolate it into a body of people, do they all become one flesh then? You know, I'd have thought that it's a dynamic which is sort of reflective of the relationship, for example, between God and Israel. So there's usually two entities involved, as, you know, the best setup for a family.
Yeah, that's obviously ideal. That's the ideal setup, is one man and one woman. But of course, Canute could appeal to the Bible for precedent and say, well, as you just pointed out there, Truefids, well, Abraham had two wives. I think there was always a primary wife, and then there would be concubines or second wives, and they would sort of take second place, from what I can recall. Under his reign, Canute brought together the English and the Danish kingdoms, and the Scandinavian and Saxon peoples saw a period of dominance across Scandinavia as well as within the British Isles. His campaigns abroad meant the tables of Viking supremacy were stacked in favour of the English, turning the prows of the longships towards Scandinavia. He reinstated the laws of King Edgar to allow for the constitution of a Danelaw and for the activity of Scandinavians at large. Canute reinstituted the extant laws with a series of proclamations to assuage common grievances brought to his attention, including on inheritance in case of intestacy and on hiriots and reliefs. He also strengthened the currency, initiating a series of coins of equal weight to those being used in Denmark and other parts of Scandinavia. He issued the law codes of Canute, known now as 1 Canute and 2 Canute, though these seem primarily to have been produced by Wulfstan of York. And in his royal court, there were both Englishmen and Scandinavians, as we've talked about before. So I guess when you have an empire like this, when you have Britain and you have Denmark, then you would have had the same economy between the two. The same coinage was being used in both Denmark and Britain. I find that interesting. Do you want to add anything to this, Truefids?
Yeah, it's always interesting that the currencies, right? That back then the king issued the money and determined it. Or obviously he would use people who were qualified in that like chancellors to do it for him. And it seems also he had a guy here, Wulfstan, who helped him codify the laws. Canute might have not been the best person for that, but he could review them and then just tell them his intentions, and Wulfstan could, you know, write it into a way that it could be codified and understood by everyone, right?
Yeah, I think there was a Bishop Wulfstan as well, so maybe it was him. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Just prompted a thought about the notion of currency back then. I mean, they'd have their head stamped on each coin, I'd have thought, and in a way you could say that it helps the king to establish dominion, you know, through the flow of money. You know, it's like where the river flows, the river of money flows. It kind of shows the extent of that king's kingdom, essentially.
Yeah, it would have also showed his subjects what he looked like. You know, the ones that hadn't actually met him, if they were ever to actually see any of this coinage. Well, Harold II died in 1018, and Canute went to Denmark to affirm his succession to the Danish crown, stating his intention to avert attacks against England in a letter in 1019. It seems that there were Danes in opposition to him, and an attack he carried out on the Wends of Pomerania may have had something to do with this. In this expedition, at least one of Canute's Englishmen, Godwin, apparently won the king's trust after a nighttime raid that he personally led against a Wendish encampment. That's the one that we've already referred to. His hold on the Danish throne, presumably stable, Canute was back in England in 1020, He appointed Ulf Jarl, the husband of his sister Estrid Svendsdatter, as regent of Denmark. And I guess that's Svein's daughter, Svendsdatter. She was married to Ulf, and he was the regent of Denmark, further entrusting him with his young son by Queen Emma, Harthacnut Canute, whom he had designated to be the heir of his kingdom. The banishment of Thorkell the Tall in 1021 may be seen in relation to the attack on the Wends, with the death of Olaf's Scott Conung in 1022 and the succession to the Swedish throne of his son, Anand Jacob, bringing Sweden into alliance with Norway, there was cause for a demonstration of Danish strength in the Baltic. Jomsborg, the legendary stronghold of the Joms Vikings, thought to be on an island off the coast of Pomerania, was probably the target of Canute's expedition. Successful, after this clear display of Canute's intentions to dominate Scandinavian affairs, it seems that Thorkell was reconciled with Canute in 1023. When in spite of this, the Norwegian king Olaf Haraldsson and Anand Jacob took advantage of Canute's commitment to England and began to launch attacks against Denmark, Ulf gave the Danish freemen cause to accept Harthacnut, still as a child, as king. This was a ruse on Ulf's part, since his role as caretaker of Harthacnut gave him the reign of the kingdom. Upon news of these events, Canute set sail for Denmark to restore himself and to deal with Ulf, who then got back in line. In a battle known as the Battle of the Helgea, Canute and his men fought the Norwegians and the Swedes at the mouth of the river Helge, probably in 1026, and the apparent victory left Canute as the dominant leader in Scandinavia. Ulf the Usurper's realignment and participation in the battle did not, in the end, earn him Canute's forgiveness. Some sources state that the brothers-in-law were playing chess at a banquet in Roskilde when an argument arose between them, and the next day, Christmas 1026, one of Canute's housecarls killed the Jarl with his blessing in Trinity Church, the predecessor to Roskilde Cathedral. So that's not very good, murdering them in the church. So this was the Ulf that called him or said that he wasn't a coward when he rescued him. So it was more the point of the fact that this Ulf had tried to take over the kingdom by making Canute's son Harthacnut, who he was looking after, by trying to make him king. So it seems there was more to that story than at first appeared when it was reported by Sharon Turner there. Truthfords, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's interesting. You get another angle and you see more of a backstory that Ulf was pretending to, you know, be pious and say, look, I'm making your son the king, but because he's just an infant, really, he's going to be ruling over, you know, the kingdom under, you know, pretending to be, you know, helping his son. But really, Canute is the king, and you can't just take it off Canute under the pretense of putting it under his son, right?
Interesting that they're brothers-in-law as well. I mean, it tends to show that power corrupts, doesn't it? You know, gold corrupts, and it even takes over family links. So, you know, I mean, all throughout history, there's been kings that have ended up killing members of their own family to prevent them from becoming king, or so that they could become king themselves. And you see the same thing happening here, unfortunately. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Maybe Ulf felt like he was owed something by Canute for obviously saving his life, right? And he maybe felt like he was brushed aside and not kind of ingratiated for such a task that, you know, he probably feels like in many ways that Canute owes him big time, you know, for giving him his life and whatnot. So I assume that would be his motive.
Good point. I mean, there could be more to it. And obviously, we're limited in the amount of time we can spend on these characters. We do our best. But yeah, there probably is more to the story there. Moving back to Wikipedia, we get to Canute's journey to Rome. His enemies in Scandinavia subdued, and apparently at his leisure, Canute was able to accept an invitation to witness the accession in Rome of the Holy Roman Emperor Conrad II. He left his affairs in the north and went from Denmark to the coronation at Easter 1027, which would have been of considerable prestige for rulers of Europe in the Middle Ages. On the return journey, he wrote his letter of 1027, like his letter of 1019, informing his subjects in England of his intentions from abroad and proclaiming himself King of all England and Denmark and the Norwegians and of some of the Swedes. Consistent with his role as a Christian king, Canute says he went to Rome to repent for his sins, to pray for redemption and for the security of his subjects, and to negotiate with the Pope for a reduction in the costs of the pallium for English archbishops, and for a resolution to the competition between the Archdiocese of Canterbury and Hamburg-Bremen for superiority over the Danish dioceses. He also sought to improve the conditions for pilgrims as well as merchants on the road to Rome. And we have a quote in his own words here. I spoke with the emperor himself and the Lord Pope and the princes there about the needs of all people of my entire realm, both English and Danes, that a juster law and securer peace might be granted to them on the road to Rome, and that they should not be straitened by so many barriers along the road and harassed by unjust tolls. And the emperor agreed, and likewise King Robert, who governs most of these same toll gates, and all the magnates confirmed by edict that my people, both merchants and the others who travel to make their devotions, might go to Rome and return without being afflicted by barriers and toll collectors, in firm peace and secure, in a just law. So that really shows you how important he is, so that his people can travel across to Rome without being harassed by having to pay on all these toll gates. Any thoughts on this, Treefits?
Yeah, it seems even back then, you know, they would set up bridges and tolls and you had to pay if you wanted to get across. So obviously people were taking advantage of this, where pilgrims would travel to Rome. Some of these could be really poor, right, and have nothing. And then they would have to constantly pay tolls and be stripped bit by bit of their, you know, money as they travel along the roads. And obviously this is what he's complaining about, right, Canute? And it's also interesting that he's there with the Pope and the Holy Roman Empire. So he must have been seen as an equal to the Holy Roman Emperor, right, to be there by the side of him with the Pope, right?
Yeah, huge prestige and status for being there and for being invited there. Patriarch, any thoughts?
I think he obviously had his own interests as well for his own kingdoms. Obviously, he didn't. He wanted his people to have certain amounts of freedom. Maybe they were, you know, they'd go out for trade purposes as well and be bringing wealth back to the country. And he probably didn't want so much of the wealth from their country being kind of bitten off, and being fed into Rome, which isn't his empire.
Well, he's negotiating for the peasants who would go on a pilgrimage to Rome. He's also negotiating for the church so that he can get the pallium cheaper. And he's also negotiating for the merchants so that they don't have to pay taxes. So, you know, he's killing three or four birds with one stone by going there as well. And also showing, you know, how he put the interests of the people of his kingdom at the center of everything. He's really showing he's a good ruler by this time, I think, covering all these different things by going to Rome. Robert, in Canute's text, is probably a clerical error for Rudolf, the last ruler of an independent kingdom of Burgundy. Hence the solemn word of the Pope, the Emperor, and Rudolf was given with the witness of four archbishops, 20 bishops, and innumerable multitudes of dukes and nobles, suggesting it was before the ceremonies were completed. Canute, without doubt, threw himself into his role with zest. His image as a just Christian king, statesman, diplomat, and crusader against unjustness seems rooted in reality, as well as one that he sought to project. A good illustration of his status within Europe is the fact that Canute and the King of Burgundy went alongside the emperor in the imperial procession and stood shoulder to shoulder with him on the same pedestal. Canute and the emperor, in accord with various sources, took to one another's company like brothers, for they were of a similar age. Conrad gave Canute lands in the Mark of Schleswig, the land bridge between the Scandinavian kingdoms and the continent, as a token of their treaty of friendship. Centuries of conflict in this area between the Danes and the Germans led to the construction of the Daneværk from Schleswig on the Schlei, an inlet of the Baltic Sea, to the North Sea. So I'm guessing maybe that was a bridge or something. Canute's visit to Rome was a triumph. In the verse of Knutsdrapa, Sigvatur Parason praises Canute, his king, as being dear to the emperor and close to Peter. In the days of Christendom, a king seen to be in favour with God could expect to be a ruler over a happy kingdom. He was surely in a stronger position, not only with the church and the people, but also in the alliance with his southern rivals. He was able to conclude his conflicts with his rivals in the north. His letter not only tells his countrymen of his achievements in Rome, but also of his ambitions within the Scandinavian world at his arrival home. And we have another quote here from Canute's letter. "I, as I wish to be made known to you, returning by the same route that I took out, am going to Denmark to arrange peace and a firm treaty in the council of all the Danes with those races and people who would have deprived us of life and rule if they could, but they could not, God destroying their strength. May he preserve us by his bounteous compassion in rule and honour, and henceforth scatter and bring to nothing the power and might of all our enemies. And finally, when peace has been arranged with our surrounding peoples, and all our kingdom here in the east has been properly ordered and pacified, so that we have no war to fear on any side, or the hostility of individuals, I intend to come to England as early this summer as I can to attend to the equipping of a fleet." And that was Canute's letter in 1027, and he was to return to Denmark from Rome, arrange for its security there, and then he, after that, sailed to England. So everything's going very, very well for him here, isn't it? He's making a name for himself as a peacemaker now as well. Trufids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's interesting, as you said, that he refers to the people by their ethnicity, right? The English, the Danes, the Swedes. He, you know, clearly that they see themselves as slightly distinct people, although they are one family, and you know, they always kept that nationality for a few generations at least, even when they stayed in. And that he clearly wants peace between all the kingdom, all the you know, nations, to keep them Christian and not to have one part raiding the other or breaking the laws, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. He looks on them as peoples, ethnic groups, rather than countries there as well. Petra, any thoughts?
From the past few paragraphs, he's just quite proactive, isn't he, in just securing his kingdom. And he doesn't seem to be too focused on his own interests are essentially the security of his kingdom, and not kind of the more carnal endeavours that other kings might have. So, yeah, I guess it's just general testament to, why he's such a great king and, revered and regarded as a great king.
Yeah, there's no sense of him being a womanizer or misusing his powers or being a gambler. And we've seen that he started out being quite brutal, putting down any pretenders. And then gradually over the years, he's got a name for himself as being very just. And this must be the high point of his reign, going to Rome and being at the same level as the new pope or the new emperor, basically. And being given a part of a country as a sign of the friendship that he had with this emperor. So this was a really, really high point, I think, in his reign. We'll probably leave it that here, I think, for now. So any final thoughts on all of this today, Trufids?
Yeah, it's just a very different kingdom back then. Obviously, it's going to change when William takes over and suddenly we get this Normandy hierarchy. But here we say he's Knut's been allowed, you know, the English to have self-autonomy and things remained relatively the same. The language must have also been, you know, kind of more Germanic or and Scandinavian back then, but it would gradually get this injection of French and drastically change the churches as well. They would have still been somewhat Anglo-Saxon, but that would all change eventually, right?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how they communicated with one another. They must have been bilingual, trilingual, and obviously they had Latin, which they could all communicate with. I mean, obviously very, very intelligent men, as well as being great fighters as well, I think. Petra, any final thoughts on all of this today?
Just how it's interesting to see how God used the kings to shape up Christendom, I think. And obviously it was never there were always moments of disruption, and it wasn't always kind of consistent peace. But over time, they clearly paved the way for God's laws and statutes to kind of be etched and embedded deeper and deeper to ultimately strengthen Christendom.
Yeah, we can see that was the same laws wherever you were in Europe, wherever you were in Christendom. They had the same biblical laws, and then maybe there were slightly different sort of secular laws in the different countries, but there was always this biblical law that you could appeal to. That was the final authority on whether something was allowed or whether it wasn't, and what the punishment should be. So I should imagine, served to unite all these different European tribes that had become Christian. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Truefits.
Thanks for having me, as always, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thank you, Sven.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back 2 weeks, I think. I think we have the Patriotic Alternative monthly update next Friday, so check us out in a couple of weeks' time. And until then, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.